on 98 FM and online. This is Phoenix FM.
Good evening. You're listening to Body Talk here on Phoenix 98 FM with me, Mel Watson. And I hope that you really are keeping fit and healthy and well. This virus, this pandemic shows no sign of lifting at the moment. So vitally important that we keep ourselves all as healthy as possible. I shall be starting off with the usual news roundup, which will be more or less virus free. And then we'll be focusing on some more hints and tips to get you through this time. Just keep you as healthy and well as possible, really, in these worrying times. So we'll start off with the news roundup. Now, this is something very good. Having 3 or 4 alcohol-free days a week could help you live longer. Drinking every day, even if it's just 1 glass of wine, raises the risk of premature death by 20%. And that starts to get significant when you're in your 70s. So, well, I said it was good, but maybe not so good if you're enjoying your drink every day. But, you know, if you want to live longer, that's some good advice, isn't it? And certainly, probably, I would imagine, good for the immune system. Having a glass or two of wine 3 days a week helps protect against cardiovascular disease, but these benefits are undone if you drink every day, say researchers. A recent study that concluded that any alcohol is bad for you, but that included people who are heavy drinkers. Researchers from Washington University in St. Louis took a closer look at light drinkers, people drinking 1 or 2 drinks a day, in an analysis that included data from more than 340,000 people between 18 and 85 years old. Overall, people who drink a little every day raise their risk of death by 20% compared to others of the same age who drink less frequently, which is no big deal when you're in your 20s and the death rate is low overall, but it starts to be a concern by the time you reach your 70s, the researchers say. Drinking every day raises the risk of cancer, although the risk is there to some extent, even if you have drink-free days. So again, I guess it maybe depends on genetics or something like that, but general advice here is that it is okay to have a small amount of alcohol, isn't it? Moderation again. And fermented dairy products, which also include kefir, quark and sour milk, reduce the risk of coronary heart disease by around 27%. And I know there's been a big uptake recently in kefir, isn't there? It's become very popular at the moment. So it's good for you, apparently. Now, a fatty diet has mostly been considered to be bad for you and causing heart disease, but actually cheese and yogurt can protect against the disease. Fermented dairy products, which also include kefir, quark and sour milk, reduce the risk of coronary heart disease where the arteries become blocked by around 27%. Researchers from the University of Eastern Finland made the discovery when they tracked the health and diets of around 2,000 men for 20 years. For over 20 years, and in that time, 472 developed CHD, but most cases were among those who followed official guidelines of eating low-fat or fat-free diets. Those who ignored the advice and ate a little dairy most days, full fat or not, did not see any increase in their risk of CHD, and fermented dairy in particular was even protective. The one exception was among those who drank large amounts of milk every day. People consuming the most milk, an average of 1.5 pints a day, increased their risk of CHD, but the risk disappeared among those who drank more moderate amounts. The researchers say they don't know why fermented dairy products should have such a positive effect, but speculate that compounds could be created in the fermentation process that protect the cardiovascular system. And type 2 diabetes is estimated to account for 10% of all healthcare costs in the US and UK, but it's a very treatable condition. For one, diabetics could control their condition by just eating a vegan diet. The plant-based diet reduces many of the typical biological markers of type 2 diabetes without the need for any drugs to control the condition, a major review has concluded. The diet also improves depression, a problem that's 3 times more common among diabetics, and general well-being as well. Researchers from the University of London have found in several tests that they've done, or bits of research that they've done on this, diabetics also lose weight on the diet as well. And the dietary change could dramatically reduce the $176 billion in annual costs in the US and £24 billion in the UK. I can't even imagine that amount of money, which is spent to manage the problem with drugs and other medical therapies. A vegan diet significantly reduces the symptoms of type 2 diabetes to the extent that drugs can be stopped or dosages lowered, the researchers discovered after they took another look at 11 previously published studies that involved 433 diabetics with an average age of 55. In fact, the diet was more successful than most of the official guidelines recommended by diabetes support groups around the world, they say. The vegan diet excludes all animal products, including dairy, and allows only fruits, vegetables, legumes such as nuts and lentils, seeds and whole grains. So it's a very restrictive diet, but then could be worth it for your health. I would definitely say that that one's worth looking into. And if a vegan diet doesn't sound too appealing, intermittent fasting can have a similar positive effect on type 2 diabetes. Fasting can reverse even the most serious cases of diabetes, requiring insulin injections. A new study has found that fasting for 24 hours intermittently, either every other day or for 3 days each week, can reverse the condition and eliminate the need for drug treatment. Diabetics who had been taking insulin were drug-free after 10 months of intermittent fasting, researchers from the University of Toronto have discovered. However, careful monitoring was necessary to ensure that there were no dangerous drops in blood sugar, and the patients weren't going entirely without food. During the 24-hour fast, they could drink low-calorie beverages such as tea, coffee, water or broth, and were allowed one low-calorie meal in the evening. Fasting was tested on three diabetics whose problem had become so advanced that they were injecting insulin every day to help break down sugars. Two intermittently fasted every other day, and the third fasted for 3 days and ate normally the other 4 days in the week. A couple of options there on treating type 2 diabetes, which I think are well worth investigating. I know it's very severe, but then ultimately it's your health, isn't it? And do you really want to be dependent on, on taking injections and, tablets and things like that? It seems a bit of a bother, doesn't it, when we can actually change it by diet. And how MS, multiple sclerosis, gets triggered is a mystery, but new research suggests that it starts in the gut, just as everything else seems to. And if so, the discovery opens the door to a therapy that could finally reverse the autoimmune disease. Researchers at the University of Zurich have been working on a gut-based solution for several years, and they believe they're close to making the therapy available to MS sufferers. They believe that the immune cells are activated in the intestine and then migrate to the brain, where they cause an inflammatory cascade, say the researchers. In people with MS T cells, the white blood cells that help govern the immune system, they react to a protein called GTPL, fucose synthase, that's found in bacteria in the gut. And in their therapy, the researchers take blood from the MS patient and then add protein fragments to the surface of the red blood cells in order to re-educate the immune system to tolerate brain tissue instead of attacking it. The only treatments for MS that are currently available shut down the whole immune system, which have serious unintended consequences. Fatty acids from fast and processed foods could be a cause of depression, and eating more fish could be the antidote. Although there are many possible reasons why people get depressed, an imbalance of fatty acids could be one. That's according to researchers at the James Cook University in Australia. Too many N6 polyunsaturated fatty acids from fast foods and too few omega-3 fatty acids, which come mainly from fish, seem to contribute to depression. The researchers were able to carry out some unique research on two islands around the Torres Strait, which were both inhabited. One of the islands had fast food outlets and the other was less developed and had no takeaway restaurants. 19 of the islanders were diagnosed as having moderate to severe depression, but only 3 of them lived on the island that didn't have fast food restaurants. Blood tests confirmed there were differences between the two communities, and it mainly came down to the levels of omega-3 and omega-6 fatty acids. The standard Western diet is far too high in omega-6, and this could be having an impact on the level of depression, the researchers say. So I think, well, we all know, really, don't we, that fast food isn't good for us. And I think we all need to be making an effort to eat less of it. And hopefully we are. But I think, judging by the supermarkets at the moment, it's generally the sort of like the chocolate and snacky and junk foody type shelves that seem to be bereft of things. And yet the healthy items on the healthy section seem to still be full. So maybe we ought to be turning that round a little bit. I'm not suggesting that we empty the health section either, but, you know, it does say something about our diets in general, doesn't it? OK, we're going to take a little break now. And after the break, yes, I'm going to be back giving you some news about coronavirus. Stay tuned for more after this. I'm a genie in a bottle, baby. Gotta run me in the right way, honey. I'm a genie in a bottle, baby. Come and let me have. I'm a genie in a bottle.
Gotta ride me the right way.
community radio for Brentwood and Billericay. This is Phoenix FM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Body Talk here on Phoenix 98 FM with me, Mel Watson. Yes, obviously we need to talk about COVID-19, coronavirus, however you're referring to it. Not a week goes by without it being mentioned. But there's always something new to report, isn't it? They're finding out new things all the time. And hopefully we're seeing a little bit of a plateau now as well. So, yeah, hopefully things are looking better than they were anyway. The latest evidence is that most people have no risk of dying from COVID-19. The bad news is the virus probably won't be eliminated by the lockdown, though. So, you know, doctors are now saying the findings so far suggest there's more that we can all do to reduce the risk of COVID-19 causing a serious illness. And figures published have shown that more than nine in 10 cases, the people who died from COVID-19 had been approaching the end of their life and had caught the virus on top of chronic life-threatening conditions such as heart or lung disease or dementia. However, it's now emerging that these statistics conceal a significant but little discussed factor, a risk factor, that's weight and obesity. Now, weight is rated according to body mass index, or BMI, and a BMI of under 25 is considered healthy, while 25 to 29 is classed as overweight, and 30 or above is obese. Intensive Care National Audit and Research Centre data has shown that 3/4 of critically ill UK COVID-19 patients were overweight or obese. Similarly, a study of just over 4,000 seriously ill COVID-19 patients by New York University showed while age is the biggest single risk factor for serious illness, obesity is a close second. With around 2/3 of British adults overweight or obese, we should really be thinking about this problem. We have daily health briefings on TV, and if they said something about weight, perhaps even if half the population took that on board, it would make a difference, possibly. Even if the UK lockdown ends next month, evidence from Japan and elsewhere in Asia indicates that we should expect a second wave in the autumn. Now, we just don't know, do we? But we need to assess our risks from a personal perspective, including getting fit and losing weight as well. Now, a small weight gain during the lockdown would make limited difference. So if you have put on a few pounds, and you know, that's not really an issue. But for future health, it's recommended that people don't gain more weight and that they take regular exercise. Excess weight makes it harder for the diaphragm and lungs to expand, which reduces oxygen supply to vital organs. And there's also a risk of bacteria and fungi growing undisturbed in the lungs, leading to pneumonia. As your weight goes up, there is less ventilation of the lungs and more risk of lung disease, in particular asthma, and increased risk of heart disease and diabetes. Overweight people already suffering from sleep apnea should be made aware of their COVID-19 risk. Sleep apnea halts breathing for short periods as the airway collapses temporarily. This is often caused by fat around the neck area, and it's most common in overweight men aged 40 or over with a shirt collar size over 16 inches. And when it comes to treatment, overweight people have more difficulty getting enough oxygen because of the weight of extra fat on their airways and are more likely to require extra help breathing with continuous positive airway pressure or mechanical ventilation. Those put on CPAP, where pressurised air is gently forced into the airway via a mask, may suffer other respiratory problems because of the difficulty of breathing out against the machine. Mechanical ventilation, where a tube is inserted into the airway, raises the risk of acute lung damage. Now, the connection between weight and increased risk of severe or fatal infection with flu-like viruses was first identified during the 2009 swine flu pandemic, which killed 284,000 worldwide. So I think we're not quite at that level yet. And let's hope we don't get there either. Now, the US has the world's worst obesity problem, but Scotland is close behind. More than 20% of Europe's swine flu deaths occurred there. And by contrast, Japan, where just 2% of adults are obese, experienced no deaths. Now, University of North Carolina's public health department said that obesity and excessive weight reduce one's immune response and ability to fight COVID-19. US research published last year has also found vaccines operate less effectively in overweight people. Meanwhile, Italian doctors found the complications of COVID-19 experienced by overweight people can be reduced by nursing them face down. Now, if you have a big belly when you lie down, the weight pushes your diaphragm upwards, reducing lung volume. And this virus is all about lung function. But suitable beds as well aren't always available. And despite the statistics, a spokesman for Public Health England insisted, we don't know if this correlation is due to obesity alone or because people who are living with obesity are more likely to have comorbidities such as type 2 diabetes, heart disease or respiratory diseases. But it seems that COVID is with us to stay, and the lockdown is a precious opportunity to find ways to improve our health while we're able to. And obviously, as everybody is saying at the moment, remember to clean your hands before and after going to the shops. Don't take a paper receipt and use your car key to punch numbers into a chip and PIN machine, and then use hand sanitizer. Bit naughty, I haven't been doing that. Because hand sanitizer. I think the problem is putting your hands into your mouth afterwards, isn't it? Or hands onto the face. So as long as when you do all that, but you're picking up bits and pieces around the shop anyway, aren't you? And at the checkout, the people on the checkout have touched the item to put it through the checkout, and then you pick it up and put it in your bag. And I know the people at the checkout are very careful and very, you know, wear gloves, etc. But they're still doing that, and they're picking up everybody's food, if you see what I mean. Can you see how that cross-contamination occurs? I don't know. I'm not trying to make everybody paranoid, but I'm just saying it seems kind of that little bit of advice that I just gave to you seems a bit like locking the door after the horse has bolted. So, yes, lots of things to remember, though, about keeping clean and hand sanitizer. And there's lots of hand sanitizer available as well now. I think people have been stocking up as well, haven't they? And then coming a little bit unstuck. I was reading about the toilet roll pandemic as well. Pandemic? Epidemic? I don't know. But the scarcity. That's the word I'm looking for. The toilet roll scarcity. It no longer exists because everybody's bought everything. And now we're finding out who bought up all the toilet rolls, aren't we? Because we've got people who are trying to sell toilet rolls because they've got too many. Well, that's ridiculous. If they've got too many toilet rolls and they're trying to sell them, they didn't need them in the first place. It's people like that that just really create problems for everybody. So, you know, just do not panic buy. I haven't panic bought this whole time. I've just used what I needed to, you know, in the assurance that there will be things in the shops. I mean, they're not going to let the shops run out of food. They're not going to let people go without things because that would be crazy. The economy still needs to keep going in some way, shape or form. Gosh, it's in a bad enough state as it is. But at least still there are some companies manufacturing items that would still be of use to us. So, and toilet rolls, I think, are manufactured in this country anyway. So I don't know why everybody was panicking, saying, oh, God, they come from China or something. Well, I guess some of them do, but not all of them. So I think sometimes we do panic a little bit unnecessarily. So, yes, just bear that in mind. And there's been a lot of talk about face masks as well. And is it good to wear one? Is it bad to wear one? Oh, there's so many different bits of advice out there, isn't it? It gets so confusing. Some people believe wearing a mask can act as a physical barrier to prevent infection with coughed or sneezed particles. And others argue that people can accidentally infect themselves when taking a mask off, and that a mask can make people less fastidious about adhering to measures proven to slow the disease's spread, such as hand washing. So, I mean, the quality of the research in this area, I think, is very poor, so we don't know. It will be as easy to make an argument for opposing the widespread use of masks as it would be to make an argument promoting their use currently. So it's all very well wearing a mask, but you know, had if you're not using the mask effectively, and I think basically you have to throw it away after every single use, and you can't put your hands to your face, you can't you know, just wipe your face or anything like that with a mask or anything. I don't know, it just gets really, really difficult, doesn't it, knowing exactly what to do. So yes, it's quite a challenge, definitely challenging times. Anyway, we're going to take a break now, and after the break, I will be back with you with more coronavirus news. Okay, right, plenty more right after this.
Watch the first line, kiss the new world, it's a wonder, maybe like you and I, all the colors of the rainbow, going somewhere, maybe like you and I, it's gonna be alright. But when my sky clouds over, lift me up. When the day is over,
take me up.
When the sun,
radio for Brentwood and Billericay. This is Phoenix FM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Body Talk here on Phoenix 98 FM with me, Mel Watson. And yes, we're talking about coronavirus. And how you can stay fit, some maybe dispelling some of the myths, perhaps. So we talked about weight just now, and that seems to be an issue possibly on some occasions. So if you were to lose weight, it may help to enhance your immune system. And one of the other things that we've been told is ibuprofen could be bad for you. So, and that's one thing that you can probably find on all the shelves at the moment, because nobody's buying ibuprofen. Whereas you can't buy paracetamol at all. Everybody's bought up all the paracetamol. It's been like that for weeks. To be precise, since the 14th of March, when French Health Minister Olivier Véran said that ibuprofen could aggravate the coronavirus infection. His comments appear to be based on four COVID-19 patients in France who have no underlying health problems and who reportedly developed serious symptoms after taking ibuprofen. Now, the theory, published in a letter in The Lancet, is that the virus binds to a receptor in the body called ACE2, and ibuprofen may increase the production of this receptor. So taking the drug might raise the risk of getting the virus or make the infection worse. Now, despite no studies proving this theory, 3 days later, the NHS advised patients to avoid taking ibuprofen to treat their symptoms and to use paracetamol instead. But the government's Commission on Human Medicines, which advises on the safety, efficacy and quality of drugs, carried out a review and has now concluded that ibuprofen and paracetamol can be safely taken for COVID-19. The review considered the available data, including that from studies in animals and clinical trials, and evidence from observational studies where patient outcomes are measured but no treatment is given, and 16 studies which considered whether ibuprofen might increase the risk of an infection worsening. There is currently insufficient evidence that ibuprofen can worsen the symptoms of COVID-19. That's according to Dr. Sarah Branch, who's Director of Vigilance and Risk Management of Medicines at the Medicines and Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency. You can take paracetamol or ibuprofen to alleviate fever and headaches from COVID-19 if you follow the instructions that come with the medicine. Patients who have been prescribed ibuprofen or other non-steroidal anti-inflammatories as a treatment for long-term conditions such as arthritis should keep taking these medicines as normal, the CHM said last week. This U-turn has been welcomed by experts who were concerned that the warning and subsequent shunning of ibuprofen had gone too far. The advice was based at best on speculation and extrapolation from studies in other conditions. And the unfounded comments about avoiding ibuprofen just went a little bit too far and led to nationwide shortages of paracetamol as people stockpiled the drug, which was unnecessary. And there are also concerns that people who take ibuprofen regularly for chronic arthritis, for example, may have stopped, and this could result in worsening symptoms, which could be painful and reduce mobility. A separate review of 13 studies by King's College London recently also found no evidence that ibuprofen could be harmful for people who have the coronavirus. Paracetamol and ibuprofen are both widely used to treat pain and fever, and ibuprofen is also an anti-inflammatory, so it tends to be better for joint pain or inflammatory conditions such as arthritis. Whenever you take a medicine of any sort, there is a risk and also a benefit. So as long as paracetamol is taken at the recommended dose, it's safe for most people. Ibuprofen can irritate the stomach, and if you take it a lot, you can develop stomach ulcers and kidney problems. If it's a straight choice between the two, then paracetamol is probably better. In fact, the NHS website recommends patients with symptoms of the coronavirus try paracetamol first because it has fewer side effects than ibuprofen. And previous studies have shown that people who take NSAIDs for coughs, colds and sore throats may be more likely to suffer severe illness or have a slower recovery than those who take paracetamol. So I guess there could be something in it, but maybe not too much. So don't avoid the ibuprofen if it's something that you actually need to be taking, in other words. And vitamin D is the latest target for researchers investigating treatment options for the coronavirus. Previous research has shown that the vitamin, which mainly comes from exposure to the sun and is essential for a healthy immune system, can help protect against other respiratory infections. And now Spanish researchers have started a 10-week trial to see if vitamin D can also help with COVID-19. So maybe we should all be taking a daily supplement to reduce our chances of getting the virus or to help our bodies fight it. The researchers at the University of Granada are carrying out a trial to investigate whether high doses of vitamin D can treat mild symptoms of COVID-19, such as headache, fever and fatigue, and prevent patients from deteriorating and needing hospital care and ventilation. 200 patients aged 40 to 70 will receive either 625 micrograms of vitamin D daily or just their usual medication. This is far higher than the 10 micrograms recommended daily dose in the UK. If the trial suggests vitamin D does prevent the coronavirus from progressing, it could potentially be used as a treatment in the community and hospitals. However, more studies will be needed to confirm the findings and the dose required to have an effect. There is not sufficient evidence to support recommending vitamin D for reducing the risk of COVID-19. So the new study is based on the finding that reduced levels of vitamin D in calves was the main cause of bovine coronavirus infection in the past. Previous studies have also shown that vitamin D can help both prevent and treat other respiratory infections. Vitamin D has an anti-inflammatory action, particularly when given at higher doses. And previous trials have looked at using it as a treatment for TB. It is the overactive inflammatory response in patients with COVID-19 that seems to be implicated with poor prognosis. And the idea is to see if it can reduce this response. A study published in the BMJ in 2017, which reviewed data from 25 trials, showed the vitamin can also help prevent acute respiratory infections, particularly in those with a vitamin D deficiency. And when vitamin D is made in the skin, it gets converted in the liver to a form that circulates around the body. And this creates a natural antibiotic-like substance in the lining of the airway that can bash viruses and bacteria, killing them. It's a generic effect, and it's not known yet whether it would work against COVID-19. But a study by Trinity College in Dublin found that adults who took vitamin D supplements saw a 50% fall in chest infections. But these results cannot automatically be extrapolated to the coronavirus. So having adequate levels of vitamin D is important for general health. It is needed for healthy bones too, for example, and will help prevent you getting sick. One in five people in the UK under normal circumstances has a vitamin D deficiency. And now with the coronavirus lockdown meaning little time outside in the sunlight, our levels could be even lower. And since 2016, the government has recommended a daily supplement of 10 micrograms to ensure we have healthy levels. Experts argue that just adhering to this advice would in itself make a big difference. To protect bone and muscle health, you should consider taking a daily supplement containing 10 micrograms of vitamin D. And vitamin C supplements have been flying off the shelves as well in the belief that the nutrient may help to protect us from the virus. And early results from a trial in China may add to the demand. Doctors in Wuhan ran a small trial to see if high-dose vitamin C can help treat severely ill COVID-19 patients. The doctors in the intensive care unit at Zhongnan Hospital, part of the University of Wuhan, gave 50 patients either 12 grams of vitamin C or a water placebo via an intravenous drip twice a day for a week, and both groups also received standard treatment, in this case an anti-clotting drug to make oxygen more available to the lungs. The patient's progress was monitored for a further 3 weeks, during which time 35% of those who got the placebo died, compared with a quarter of those who had the vitamin C drip. Now, according to the research, the sickest patients showed the most benefit from the treatment. They had less inflammation in their lungs and spent less time on ventilation. And the dose used in the trial was far higher than the 40 milligrams daily intake advised by the NHS. And vitamin C cannot be stored in the body. Any excess is removed in urine and high doses can cause diarrhea. That's true when you're well, but vitamin C is a key part of the body's immune response to infection and gets used up very quickly as the virus takes hold. No patients suffered bowel problems in the trial. So then it was decided to investigate high-dose vitamin C as a potential treatment for COVID-19 because of previous research. It had been used in patients during the SARS epidemic 17 years ago, and they showed signs of improvement. And a report published at the time said that the possibility that vitamin C affects severe viral respiratory tract infections would seem to warrant further study. David Smith, who's an emeritus professor of pharmacology at the University of Oxford, adds the latest trial from China does make the case for more studies using high-dose vitamin C in intensive care, but we will have to wait until the full report to see the complete figures. So, there's no downside to following this advice, and who knows, it might have a benefit in reducing susceptibility to the virus as well. Why not give it a try? So there we are. Right, we're going to take another little break now, and after the break I shall be back with some more helpful advice.
Games, changes and fears, when will they go from here? When will they stop? I believe that fate has brought us here, and we should be together, babe, but we're not. I play it off, but I'm dreaming of you, and I'll keep my cool, but I'm feeling I try to say goodbye and I choke, I try to walk away and I stop. Seem all right and smile when you leave, but my smiles are just a front, just a front.
Community Radio for Brentwood and Billericay. This is Phoenix FM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Body Talk here on Phoenix 98 FM with me, Mel Watson. Yes, so more coronavirus advice. So What can we do in our lockdown, our present lockdown situation? What can you do to stop feeling lonely, low? Because many of us will be at the moment, and having to self-isolate can be difficult, but there are things we can do to look after our mental well-being. Just try to create a routine for your day, finding time for physical exercise, as physical and mental health are connected. Exercising produces feel-good chemicals and reduces the levels of the stress hormone cortisol, so it will help calm you down. And maintaining a healthy diet and connecting with nature, even just tending to plants in the home, can help boost your well-being too. And if you find news about the pandemic stressful, you might find it helpful to have a set time once a day or every 2 days when you look at it for a limited period. And of course, do prioritise keeping in touch with your family and friends via video chat, phone or text. And in some cases, when a person has the coronavirus or any type of infection, their immune system goes into overdrive. So to fight the virus, the body releases proteins called cytokines, which orchestrate the body's immune response, resulting in inflammation. But in some, this process runs out of control. As more immune cells pour in, the inflammation gets worse, and this can cause organ failure and be deadly. This is known as a cytokine storm. And why it occurs in some people is not known. And all pregnant women, regardless of how far along they are in the vulnerable category and should follow social distancing measures. It's a precautionary measure, as this is a new virus and we don't know if there is a real risk to mother and fetus. And so far, the evidence is reassuring and suggests that pregnant women are no more likely to get the virus nor be seriously unwell if they do catch it. And generally, babies seem to recover well if they catch it. The government currently advises that where parents do not live in the same household, children under 18 can be moved between their parents' homes, but it's advisable to keep movement to a minimum if possible. And if you're considered particularly vulnerable to the virus, you will have been contacted by the NHS and asked to shield. This means you should stay indoors and not even go outside for exercise unless it's in your own garden. And some people who have diabetes fall into this category and will have received a letter, but most won't and will be social distancing like the rest of us. Socialising, that seems like a wonderful dream at the moment, doesn't it, being able to socialise? But everyone should continue to try to get some daily exercise, even if they are shielding at home. And we know the coronavirus can persist on surfaces for hours or days, although exactly how long depends on the surface. Even then, it's unclear whether the virus would still be infectious. We know that bacteria in general can be spread through clothing and dirty towels, and you could assume the same for viruses. So if you've been in an area with a high risk of the virus being present, such as hospitals or public transport, put worn clothes in the washing machine at 60 degrees as soon as you get home and wash your hands after handling the clothes. And around 1 million people with serious health conditions have been instructed to shield to reduce the risk of them catching the virus. You should call your GP or hospital team if you think you should have had a letter but haven't got one. And the letter outlines measures you should take to avoid contact with others and the support available to you, such as help with collecting groceries and prescriptions. And in the meantime, if you meet certain criteria, you can request support from volunteer groups such as NHS volunteer responders and mutual aid networks, which can help with getting essentials in, or simply call for a chat. And disinfection of large areas is sensible if they're going to be used by people susceptible to the coronavirus infection, because as we know, the virus can persist on surfaces for a period of time. This approach might be used in warehouses, supermarkets, public transport and health facilities. However, under lockdown, the idea is that people are not going to be on the streets, so it's not really feasible that large-scale disinfection of outdoor areas, where few, if any, people are going, would be a good use of resources. Once restrictions are lifted and we know more about the remaining threat of the virus, then infection control measures will need to be considered. And there are reports from China of a small number of cats being infected with COVID-19 from humans and transmitting the virus to other cats. But there have been no confirmed reports of cats infecting humans, and dogs don't seem to be affected either. It's unlikely that the virus is established in the UK cat population, and there is no evidence of cats being a source of the virus in the UK. and essential cancer treatments should continue at this time. The NHS has worked hard to separate patients with COVID-19 from those needing other medical care, and in some cases placing cancer treatment in different hospitals. And doctors will decide on a case-by-case basis whether the risk of COVID-19 outweighs the risk of changing a cancer treatment, and you need to contact your cancer team to discuss your concerns. And hay fever medicines, in case you were wondering, what work by blocking a specific aspect of the immune system linked to allergic reactions. And this is very different from the immune responses that are triggered to respond to the coronavirus. So it's not going to affect anything so far as that's concerned. And a problem with dentists. All high street dentists are now closed and no face-to-face appointments are allowed during lockdown. So if you have a dental problem, call your usual practice. They may be able to give you advice over the phone and prescribe painkillers or antibiotics if appropriate. And if your problem is urgent, your dentist may refer you to one of the urgent dental care centres that have been set up. Only if there is a danger of the airway being compromised would you be advised to go to A&E. And the best approach to prevent contamination in the first place is regular hand washing, and that will prevent the virus getting onto all your surfaces, especially if you're working at home, will prevent it from getting onto your keyboard. If your keyboard or mobile phone needs cleaning, wipe it with a cloth lightly sprayed with an alcohol sanitizer, and the virus should not be building up on keyboards if people are washing their hands regularly. And at the moment, there is no evidence you can catch the virus from food, and it's unclear whether traces on packages would be enough to cause an infection. But just when shopping, obviously dispose of the whole package. And if somebody makes some cakes for you or something like that, it's very unlikely that they would be passing anything on in terms of infection. So, you know, homemade things are still good to eat and will be good for the system as well. And it's important that we do wash our hands regularly to help prevent the spread of the virus, but it will take its toll on your skin. And alcohol gel can have a similar drying effect on the skin too. So make sure you dry your hands thoroughly each time you wash them to help prevent skin damage, and use a hand cream afterwards to keep the skin moisturised. And if you're experiencing a rash or itching regularly, use a moisturising treatment that creates a protective film on the skin to trap moisture to reduce the irritation. And obviously we can't meet up with anybody at the moment, taking, you know, even if it's a neighbour, even if you've both been in isolation and have no symptoms, it's important that we have clear rules for everyone and that we all stick to them. So there's a possibility that you could pick up the virus from moving around outside the home and not just from each other. So just take the long-term view. If you are vulnerable, stay in isolation for the full 12 weeks recommended for high-risk groups by the government in order to enjoy everybody's company in the future. You could phone or video call, but I know that's a bit difficult for elderly, isn't it? And without a specific test, you can't be sure that symptoms that you may be experiencing are or have been COVID-19. The advice, therefore, for everybody is to self-isolate for 7 days from when your symptoms start. However many times this occurs is irrelevant, as most people won't be tested, so we just have to assume there is a risk. Now, as the case of the Prime Minister Boris Johnson shows, he had mild symptoms at first and tested positive for coronavirus on March the 27th, 10 days before he was admitted to hospital. And some people have symptoms of COVID-19 for longer than others. And patients with symptoms are considered infectious, regardless of how long those symptoms have been ongoing. The government currently advises that those who have a temperature after 7 days should continue self-isolating until it returns to normal. And the only way you can tell if you've got COVID or had COVID is to have an antibody test, and that isn't available in the UK yet. So far, we don't know whether anybody is a carrier once you've had it and got better. There are emerging reports from South Korea, China and Italy of people who've recovered from COVID-19 who then test positive for the virus later on. However, these are small numbers of people and it's not clear whether they were reinfected with the virus or were still carrying it after the symptoms are gone. So if you have virus particles in your respiratory tract, you could pass on the infection through breathing, sneezing, or coughing. And the virus particle will be infectious if it's intact, whether it's in water or on a surface. But our public water supply to households in the UK is treated with chlorine, which is a disinfectant. So contamination of our supply is extremely unlikely. And furthermore, wastewater goes through a treatment process that would likely remove the virus. And the pneumonia that patients with COVID-19 develop is due to the virus. So the pneumococcal vaccine, which protects against bacteria that can cause pneumonia, will not prevent it or offer any protection. And one more for you. Bleach is highly toxic to all biological systems and far too harsh to use on skin, certainly. But you could use it to wipe down surfaces in the bathroom or kitchen, because that would be really good. Okay, so that's all my hints and tips on the virus for this week. Hopefully we're not going to have too many more shows with topics like this in this very anxious time, but trying to keep upbeat, trying to keep positive about this and giving you hints and tips on how to stay healthy and well. And obviously not forgetting our wonderful NHS, who are doing their absolute best as well to keep us all on the right track. So goodness knows what those people are going through at the moment, but yeah, absolutely angels, to do what they're doing, and hats off to them. Wonderful. Okay, so now unfortunately it's the end of the show, so it's been great being with you once again this week, and I'll be back again next week. So until then, take care of your body and take care of yourself.
Somebody.